I don't have any relationships to disclose. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the policy context for all this incredible science and data around the use, the routine use of antimicrobials in food production and meat production, and the transfer of that resistance to the human population. And one of the ways I like to frame this is to think about the ecosystem, the broader ecology, really the microbial ecology. And Stuart Levy's talked about how bacteria don't live in our world, we're actually part of their ecology. And their ecology encompasses farms and you know, the broader environment as well. There's a lot of things that we've talked about that come into play in terms of this ecological transfer of resistance. There's the fact that Dr. Price mentioned that these resistance genes are quite mobile. They get passed between different species of bacteria. They can also just be released into the environment. So if you've got a manure lagoon that's collecting a lot of manure from these animals that are fed antibiotics, they will pass resistant bacteria into the manure from where it can get into the environment, and other bacteria could potentially pick it up. There are studies showing that the resistant bacteria get aerosolized in the manure in the air, and they can drift, you know, great distances downwind of these large confinement sheds, for example. So anyway, a broad way of saying this is antibiotic or antimicrobial use anywhere potentially could have an impact on resistance anywhere else using this ecological frame. Well, another way to think about antibiotics, you know, nobody would dispute that antibiotics have been this incredible tool for human health, right? And with that in mind, they're really a common good. The fact that we have antibiotics that still work is a common good, much like clean air or clean water or a resilient climate are common goods. But there's a public policy problem with common goods that people have talked about a lot called the tragedy of the commons. And what that means is that they're individuals acting independently out of their own financial or self-interest can erode the benefit of that commons for everybody else. And this is in fact what we're seeing with these antimicrobials used in livestock production, where they're being used very routinely. They're not, by and large, for health purposes. They're not for the animal's health. They're mainly for growth promotion or disease or feed efficiency, and in some cases, what's called disease prevention, although the categories get a little blurry. And so, really, who's benefiting from this is not the public at large, it's the livestock producers and the companies selling those products. Now, on the other hand, the burden of more resistant infections falls on all of us, but it falls heavier on certain parts of the population. We heard about workers, chicken catchers, as well as farmers and farm workers, other kinds of farm workers. They're more likely to get resistance. People eating meat raised with routine antibiotics are more likely to be exposed to resistant bacteria. But then there's also people who, you know, due to their income or other status, maybe they lack access to health insurance. If they do get a resistant infection, it's going to go on longer. It's going to have greater health impacts on them, et cetera. So the interesting thing about this from a policy standpoint is that going back 25 years, there's been, or more, there's actually been acknowledgement of what we need to do. Because resistance is kind of an environmental phenomena, the thing that makes the most sense is just to reduce antibiotic use wherever you can, right? It doesn't even work to invent new classes of antibiotics because we've not been very successful at that. The pharmaceutical companies aren't investing in it, and it's actually getting harder and harder to come up with novel drug classes. And even when they do come up with a new class of drugs, the resistance now comes about fairly quickly. much, much quicker than it used to. So 25 years later, an NIS study too concluded that reducing antibiotic use in agriculture as well as in human settings was what made the most sense to tackle the problem. So how do we do that? Well, really, for the most part, for the last 30 years or so, we've relied on voluntary regulation by the meat industry. And it hasn't worked terribly well, as you've seen. And you know, this is what happened in Quebec, too, as we just heard. There have been some progressive companies that have started sourcing meat raised with fewer antibiotics, but this leads to a very uneven playing field, and it's really not very fair to the consumer because oftentimes, depending on your knowledge level, it can be difficult to know whether a producer or a food company is sourcing meat produced with fewer antibiotics or more antibiotics. There's not good labels to tell you, for example, what's going on. So other policy options then really boil down to either stricter regulation, and it's the Food and Drug Administration that has regulatory purview over these animal uses, just like they do over the human uses, although it's a different part of the agency. Or legislation. So let's talk about regulation. Well, just to get an example of how this can actually work, we have a case study from Europe where Denmark, and it wasn't strictly speaking a regulatory step, it was actually the meat producing industry in Denmark said, we want to drastically ramp back on our antibiotic use in livestock production and poultry production. And we want you to help us. And so the public health and veterinary health authorities in Denmark did that. And in fact, they phased out all of this routine growth promotion use of antibiotics from 98 to 99. Now later, a panel was convened by the World Health Organization to evaluate this experience. And the data from Denmark shows pretty conclusively that by making this change, they were able to reduce total antibiotic use by 54%. So huge success. And in fact, what the WHO panel concluded was that eliminating that routine or growth promotion use of antibiotics reduced the human health risks, didn't significantly affect retail prices at the grocery store, didn't affect animal health significantly, didn't affect farmers' incomes. And in large part, that's because they did it across the entire country. It wasn't this uneven playing field that we have in the US right now. So that's a pretty good model. Let's see how that impacted resistance in animals and humans. Well, here's two specific examples. We've never approved avoparcin for use in the US, but in Europe they had approved a growth promoter use of avoparcin, which in fact was linked to resistance in Enterococcus glycopeptide resistance. And what the data from the Danish authorities shows pretty clearly is that when they got rid of the avoparcin, the resistance in the broiler chickens as well as on the meat had a pretty clear decline afterwards. And we saw this too with something called virginiamycin. Virginiamycin is the animal streptogramin analog to cinersid, which is an important human drug. So here too, when virginiamycin use was stopped in, routine use was stopped in poultry production in Denmark, you see this pretty clear decrease on the graph in both the broiler chickens and on the meat from those chickens. So now if you put this together with the data from Canada that we just saw, we've got basically three different examples of where when you stop using, you know, proactively take this public health step of stopping the use, the routine use in either hatcheries or in broiler chickens, you see this reduction in resistance on the meat in the birds, and we saw in humans too. So FDA could, using its authority, just take off the market its approvals for the antibiotics that are currently used as growth promoters. And in fact, they had made a decision to do so in 1977. They had proposed a ban on penicillin and tetracyclines, which at that point were the two most common animal growth promoters. What happened? Well, basically, Congress intervened and said, don't do that. And they ordered a study and then more study, and basically nothing happened. So the proposal went nowhere. And in the interim, environmental groups like the Natural Resources Defense Council petitioned this ongoing use as an imminent hazard. FDA denied the petition. Another petition was lodged in 1999 to eliminate these routine uses of seven medically important antibiotics. This petition has not been accepted either. And that's basically where we're at today. And in fact, the FDA has never removed an approved antibiotic feed additive from the market. And so what you're left with is some skepticism about the FDA's willingness or ability. And to be clear, you know, the FDA's got a lot on its plate, and it's always resource starved too. And these things are not easy, but for whatever reason, they haven't been terribly successful at reducing uses using their regulatory authority. Now, as Lucy discussed, another example of, this is not a growth promoter use, but in the US, we also use these cephalosporins off-label. Do people understand what off-label means? It basically means that if FDA approves a particular class of drugs for one use, you can use it for anything else off-label without a specific approval. So cephalosporins are a really critical class of human drugs. And recognizing that, in July of 2008, FDA issued a final order that was going to be effective in October, making it illegal to use cephalosporins like ceftiofur off-label in food-producing animals. Well, what happened? Suddenly, in November of that year, 2008, they revoked the order. Not clear why. The Wall Street Journal wrote about it. They said, something's going on. We're not sure what. Subsequently, I work with a campaign called Keep Antibiotics Working. We've twice written to the FDA saying, you know, we urge you to reinstate this order. I'm glad to hear from Lucy that the FDA has indicated, at least to Canada, that they're planning on reissuing the order. But it's now 2 years down the road. And that's two more years of off-label cephalosporin use. And as we're seeing from some of the data presented, two more years of increasing cephalosporin resistance across multiple bacteria species. So, can the FDA act in a timely way? Whether it's to take off the market these growth promoter uses or even these off-label uses, it's really unclear. There have been other non-antibiotic drugs that were used in animal feed, like DES, diethylstilbestrol, was an animal growth promoter. Not sure how many of you knew that. That took 6 years to get out of animal feed. Nitrofurans, carcinogens, 20 years. And so, actually, a former director of the agency in charge of this division at the FDA has said in a letter to us that the agency's experience with formal withdrawal basically is not a good one. It eats up a lot of staff time and resources. And he went on in that letter to say that FDA is unclear that it has the authority, the legal authority to do this. Well, we disagree, but that was his view. So I want to just mention, I'm not going to talk in detail about this, but the latest round of the policy context is that the current leadership of FDA indicated in June with a draft guidance called Guidance 209 that they really think that this routine antimicrobial use in livestock production is a public health problem, and that they wanted comment on their guidance. But the guidance has no concrete action steps. It has no proposal to withdraw any particular uses, and it basically, in our opinion, boils down to a call for voluntary action by the industry. So that's not very hopeful, and subsequently many groups, including Keep Antibiotics Working and Pew and many other NGOs, collaborated to get 180,000 public comments to the FDA saying, we think you ought to really do something beyond this guidance. And so that brings us to legislation. Now, for several years, there's been a bill introduced, and the original author was Senator Kennedy, but since his passing, Senator Feinstein has stepped forward as the supporter in the Senate, and Representative Slaughter in the House. She's the only microbiologist in Congress, by the way. And it's called the Preservation of Antibiotics for Medical Treatment Act. About 370 organizations endorse it, including the AMA, the APHA, the Nurses Association, Pediatrics, many state medical societies and departments of health, and several hundred other groups. And what it would basically do is sunset the existing FDA approvals for the routine uses of these medically important antibiotics, unless the manufacturers could submit data to demonstrate that they don't pose any harm to the human population. Okay? And it would give them 2 years to do that. What would this not do? It wouldn't, contrary to what the industry often claims, it wouldn't deprive farmers of any antibiotics. There are many other non-critically important drugs that they can still use. There are many other non-antibiotic drugs that they can use for these same purposes. That wouldn't change. They could still treat sick animals, just not on a routine basis. That is to say, when animals are sick, you treat them, they get better. It's not these uses that are basically over the entire lifespan of the animal. So you heard earlier that there was a hearing around this legislation and this issue in July. It's continued to get a great deal of attention. It's unclear what the leadership change in the House is going to spell for this bill, although it's probably not a good thing. So just to wrap up, that you may have heard food safety legislation has been worked on. I don't track this incredibly closely, but the last I heard it stalled, isn't that right? And in any case, it's kind of interesting the way we titled this session, because even though clearly these are very important food safety issues, they don't really fall under the category of food safety the way a food safety bill would define it. So our approach to food safety has been a little narrow, arguably. So this is the URL if you want more information about Keep Antibiotics Working. We've been working on this issue for 10 years, and there's a lot of resources there. In particular, we've got an annotated bibliography of many of the major studies across 7 different strands of evidence linking antibiotic use in livestock production and human health impacts. And then my own group is also trying to mobilize health professionals to speak out with a stronger voice on this issue and others. So I thank you all for your patience, and I look forward to your questions.
So thank you, David, and I'd like to take this time to open the floor for any questions. All the way in the back.
Potentially putting you at risk, even if you chose organic products that are Well, I think that's a good point. So, I mean, when we do these comparative studies, and there's a number of them that have been published, including some of my own, I mean, there is a difference with respect to the raised without antibiotics products versus those conventional products as far as the level of drug-resistant bacteria. But those animals actually also live a little bit longer, and so sometimes the trade-off is that you'll have occasionally higher contamination rates with Salmonella or Campylobacter too, but they're not as resistant. So, you know, there is this trade-off, and I think the problem too is that there's this leak. It's a leaky system, right? So you have the broiler belt, right? And if you have you have 9 billion chickens that are being raised in the broiler belt and houses with tunnel ventilation systems blowing the bacteria into the environment. And then you have a sole producer out there that's producing without antibiotics. Those bacteria can spread to those animals too. And we see it, the older antibiotics, I mean, there's tetracycline-resistant bacteria everywhere. It doesn't matter which brand we're choosing. We find them there. And so it's only the newer antimicrobials that we actually see a significant difference, a substantial difference. And, you know, it's a mess. I mean, I think we, on a mass balance, we have to decrease that selection for drug-resistant bacteria, though. And I think the only way we do that is on a national scale.
Yeah, I would say, though, that, you know, I think just about everybody agrees that of all the different potential routes where the resistant bugs and the resistance genes can travel from the farm into the human population, food is still, you know, almost without doubt the most important route. And because the levels of resistance of the bugs on organic meats is lower, that still seems like a good bet. Of course, it doesn't have to be certified organic. It could also be a farmer who just says, I don't use antibiotics. I mean, that's what I do. I buy a quarter of a pig from the farmer who doesn't use them. It's not organic, but, you know, I trust him. The other thing to say, I think, is that the contamination, at least the studies I've looked at, either through aerosol or groundwater contamination, it tends to be right around those facilities that are using the antibiotics. There's less evidence that it travels long distances. You know, it's still contributing, I think, probably in some way to the the notion that we're creating more environmental reservoirs of resistance, but
I think it depends on the organism,
yeah,
and
depends on the organism.
So staph and the, you know,
right,
ST398 in the Netherlands is an example where it's spreading into the community, but it largely looks through the occupational exposure,
through the farmers and through the veterinarians. And there have actually been interesting studies. One in particular, where at a veterinarian conference, they swabbed themselves to test for this ST398 strand, and a significant percentage of the vets were carriers. Mm-hmm.
They can call it organic. You're pretty non-committal with your sessions, aren't you? Promiscuous, I'd say. We should swab him, actually. That's a big concern for us, right? So we're using this animal waste as fertilizers. 9 billion food animals make a lot of poo, right? And every year we use that waste. The cheapest way to get rid of it, and the way we get rid of it, is to apply it as fertilizers to grow crops. And, you know, we're overloading the land with this, and it's contaminating the water. But also, I think that we're seeing a lot of this. I imagine that a lot of this is coming through the vegetable food supply, too. We're starting some more studies on that. It's been really an understudied thing. But, you know, you look at the Consumer Reports came out with a study just earlier this year, and they showed that something like 30% of bagged lettuce, the triple washed bagged lettuce, had Enterococcus and E. coli at standards higher than what it would be acceptable for water levels. And so they didn't keep the isolates, though, and so we weren't able to test whether they were resistant or not. But this is a place where we want to go. It's important. Yes?
The resistance to milk,
Is the resistance in milk, so you mean, so like the dairy cows?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there are different patterns of antibiotic use in dairy cattle, and that, and I'm not probably the best person to answer.
Yeah, I can say. In general, they most of the use is for intramammary use, and we don't see as much resistance, well, although we don't see a lot of resistance in beef cattle in general at the end of their life anyway. So it doesn't seem like it's that much of a problem. And it's not that there's no problem, but it's not for us anyway in Canada, and I can't talk about the dairy industry in the US because it's quite different, but we don't see as many issues with it. And it seems that the use, because you know they can't, all those, it's like the layers, they can't use antimicrobials that much because they always produce food, and there's withdrawals period for most of those drugs except ceftiofur. So you know they have to limit their use. So they do use antimicrobials, but I think because of this pressure of not being able to use the drugs, it does have an impact on the level of resistance we find in those.
And I've seen comparative studies, organic herds to conventional herds, and lower drug resistance among the organic herds, but. You know, it's a whole set of different set of rules when you're having a milk producing cow being treated with antimicrobials. Yes. So the question, so your question basically is, are vegetarians or non-vegetarians, do they have any different risk levels as far as carrying drug-resistant bacteria?
I mean, have we really proven that the consumption factor is really the issue?
Well, I mean, so I think there are a number of studies showing that consumers that have nothing to do with the food animal industry are picking up.
I mean,
right, so there's mixed studies on that, right? So there are some studies that show that there's a significant difference. Jim Johnson found the same poultry-associated E. coli in vegetarians and non-vegetarians. And so I see sort of a secondhand smoke model for that, where, you know, it's the risk behaviors of this one group, if you can call them that, that, you know, they're contaminating the kitchen, they're cross-contaminating the foods that the other people are eating. And so it's not so much eating the, you know, a properly cooked piece of chicken is probably safe, but when you're bringing that raw food into your house and then contaminating across the kitchen, or think in a commercial kitchen where you're preparing thousands of chicken breasts and then you go make the salad, or, you know, because that's all vegetarians eat are salads, right? But so I think the cross-contamination. And then the other big risk factor that's been shown in a couple of studies is living with somebody else that has drug-resistant bacteria in their gut, right? So the world's covered in a thin layer of fecal matter, and, you know, who you live with counts. So living with a non-vegetarian is, you know, can be a risk factor. I'm not a vegetarian. I'm a hypocrite. Okay, yeah. Strongly opposed. It defies all logic, actually. So this PAMTA, the Preservation of Antibiotics for Medical Treatment Act, would increase the need for veterinarians, right? You'd increase jobs for veterinarians. They are the ones at the greatest risk for these animal diseases, for picking up the drug-resistant bacteria, and yet they're totally against it. And our understanding is that there's, you know, the kind of the upper echelon of AVMA are really tight with the food animal industry. What's that? Well, so you're a vet, small animal vets. Yeah, but the official group, AVMA, have come out strongly against it and have testified.
There's quite a few public health veterinarians that are quite exercised by AVMA's stand and, you know, have tried to had those discussions within AVMA. So, you know, like any organization, the position doesn't necessarily reflect the views of all of its members.
Yeah. Maybe one thing I can add is I think it's the same in Canada as it is here. The resistance files seems to be viewed by most veterinarians like a public health problem, and they don't see that there's also an animal health problems. When you look at the resistance profile of the animal pathogens, there's a reason why they're starting to pick in the, you know, in the ceftiofur, and, you know, just because the other ones are not working anymore. But it seems like they feel attacked, and they totally forget. They don't see this other big thing coming, like this big bus coming on them. They don't seem to take action to try to reduce, you know, use just to try to control resistance in their own pathogens. And actually, I'm going to give a talk on Friday to vets and try to advocate for that, because I think it's probably one thing they have to realize, that it's not just a public health issue. It's also an animal health issue. And if they can work towards, you know, trying to keep their antibiotic effective for their animals, I think, you know, we probably would benefit from that on the public health side as well.
We definitely need more vets to speak out, actually. So what you're saying is that as a vet, if you speak out loudly against something like this, you can lose access to the very place where you need to go in? There's a lot of economics involved on all sides.
So we've got time for one more question, and hopefully our panelists will be available for individual questions after the session's over. So if you're the last one, that's great. Go ahead.
I mean, I wouldn't say that we were absent. I mean, the labeling could be better, right? But there actually is a USDA-approved grass-fed label that's basically an antibiotic-free label. It's not used widely. The certified organic label is, you know, good with some of the loopholes that you mentioned. There are certain producers who are well known for not using antibiotics as part of the production model, like Nyman Ranch. And then there's just personal relationships, the CSA model, buying direct, you know, buying at farmers markets. So it's not that people are without options, it's that it's not as easy or transparent as it ought to be.
But yes, wash your hands and wash your cutting boards and be careful in the kitchen. All those things still stand.
Definitely. But
there are good options out there. So you just research a little.
Social justice. I mean, so that's true in my community, but, you know, I see patients in a, you know, community where, you know, very low income, it's a minority neighborhood, there isn't, you know, there isn't this type of labeling, there isn't this type of transparency. And so, you know, what do I advise my patients?
That's right. That's why it is a social justice issue in part.
It's one of the things that we talk about a lot is that, you know, why should only the wealthy people in our society be able to afford the safer foods, and you know, I think you have to tell them to cook their food really well and wash their hands. You know, you can't tell them to go to Whole Foods.
So thanks very much to our panelists, and thank you for coming.